Well, I'm sure it hasn't escaped your attention that today is not just Easter Day, it's April Fool's Day, the 1st of April as well. And I'm sure you've got a favourite April Fool, maybe one you played, maybe one that was played on you. Maybe one of those that comes back to us from time to time. Carrie reminded us of a number this morning, a sort of a white elephant at Berlin Zoo, the spaghetti trees in Switzerland, which I guess is possibly the most famous one, the left-handed burger. I think one of my favourites was that series of supplements that a newspaper did, telling you all about these non-existent islands in exotic parts of the world and what wonderful investment opportunities they were and what great hotels they had and what fantastic holidays you could enjoy there. And then, of course, if you've been on the BBC Sport website today, they've got the grandstand with Des Lynam standing at the front telling you what a brilliant team he's got working for him. And behind, in the studio, the team are having a fight and sort of punching each other's lights out. April Fool's Day. And it's appropriate in many ways that Easter Day falls on April Fool's Day. Because is the resurrection one of the greatest April Fools of all time? Are you the fool if you believe it? Or are you the fool if you reject it? Who then is the Easter fool? In the Gospel accounts, is it Pontius Pilate? Is it the religious leaders? Is it the disciples? Today, is the Easter fool the one who believes that Jesus rose from the dead? Or the one who says he didn't? Have a look at verse 64 for a moment. The religious leaders say to Pilate, "Therefore, order the tomb to be made secure until the third day." That was the day on which it was reckoned far too late for anybody to possibly survive. If you stayed in the tomb the third day, you were definitely dead. That's the significance of the third day. Lest his disciples go and steal him away and tell the people he has risen from the dead. And the last fraud will be worse than the first. To them, Jesus is just an imposter. And he's already perpetrated one fraud on the people. He's got them to believe, some of them at least, that he is the Messiah. This last fraud that he's risen from the dead would be the very worst of all. So, who's playing the fool at Easter time? Who ends up being the Easter fool, both then and now? Well, first of all then, the Easter fool says Jesus did not rise from the dead. And Matthew is very keen to make it clear to us that a number of the common objections simply won't hold water. First of all, that Jesus did not die. Have a look at verse 57. Joseph Arimathea, a disciple of Jesus, goes to Pilate and asks for the body of Jesus. And Pilate orders it to be given to him. The other Gospels tell us that Pilate checked first to make sure Jesus really was dead, because it appeared he was quite surprised that it happened so quickly. Now, we know that the flogging Jesus received before crucifixion, that in and of itself could have killed him. But it certainly weakened him sufficiently such that he wouldn't have stayed alive long on the cross. And at this particular time of year, this particular year, that was important, because with a Jerusalem full of people for festival, for Passover, the Romans didn't want to upset the crowds by leaving dead bodies on crosses on the Sabbath, particularly a festival Sabbath. So no, Jesus was dead. Those involved knew what they were doing. They understood what death was about. We need have no doubt about that. And the historic creeds of the church have expressed that in three ways. The creeds say Jesus was crucified, died, and was buried. Three ways of telling you that Jesus is dead. The second thing that people often say, second thing that the Easter fools say, is that the women and the disciples visited the wrong tomb. But did you notice the way in which Matthew gives a link from each of the key moments and the key events to the next one. And that link is the women. Look back at verse 56. They're there at the crucifixion. Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James and Joseph, and the mother of the sons of Zebedee. Then the body is taken down, wrapped and placed in Joseph's tomb. What do we read verse 61? Mary and the other Mary, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary were there, sitting opposite the tomb. And it is they, verse 1 of chapter 28, who come the next day to pay their devotions to Jesus. They are the eyewitnesses. They have seen each place. They know exactly what they're doing. And because of the very reverential way in which Jewish people, close friends, family would have regarded the dead body, they want to pay their respects. They want to do their best by the dead Jesus. And so they would not ever have messed up which tomb he was in. They couldn't possibly have got that wrong. But let's just pause for a moment. Let's just say, okay, maybe they did get it wrong. Well then, why didn't somebody simply produce the body from the right tomb if it was just sitting there? Once the rumour started, that's all you've got to do, isn't it? Just do that. Thirdly, the Easter fool says the disciples stole the body. And we get these two comical scenes. The religious leaders, they sort of set the whole thing up. And yet it is their fear of Jesus doing what he said he would do that gives greater credence to the truth of the resurrection. They come to Pilate, and Pilate says to them, verse 65, you have a guard of soldiers, probably at temple guards. Go make it as secure as you can. Make the tomb as secure as you can. So they went and made the tomb secure by sealing the stone and setting a guard. So there's a cord around the stone with wax seals on it, and there are soldiers there. Temple guards are there. But of course, it all goes horribly wrong, doesn't it? There's the earthquake, the angel appears, the guards are struck dumb. They trembled and became like dead men, we're told. So, another plan is put into place. They're given money, verse 12, and they say, tell people his disciples came by night and stole him away while we were asleep. Well, there are two problems with that, aren't there? If they were asleep, how did they know who came, when, and what they did? If one of them woke up, why didn't he wake the others up to stop what was going on from happening? Absolutely colander-like in its holiness. And of course, even if the disciples had stolen the body, it's still got to be accounted for. It needs to be somewhere, doesn't it? And we also know that keeping that sort of a lie watertight is pretty much impossible. Humanity has a very bad track record of keeping that sort of secret. Some of you will remember the Watergate conspiracy around the American presidency some years ago. And even then, a relatively small band, totally committed to doing what they'd done and making sure nobody else found out about it, couldn't hold it together. And the whole thing fell apart. And don't forget, these Christians, they continued to hold on to the resurrection even when threatened with death. All they had to do was to deny it and they'd be fine. So, three things which at Matthew's account simply won't let us get away with. But maybe you're still not sure. Maybe you're not there yet on the resurrection. Well, don't give up. Keep looking. Keep reading. I gather we've run out of all the books we had earlier. But if you're interested, do grab me afterwards. I've got a rather beaten up copy of the Lee Strobel Case for Easter book. If you want that, you're welcome to have it. Because we don't want anybody here tonight to end up being an Easter fool, do we? Who is the Easter fool? The one who believes in the resurrection or the one who does not? Secondly, then, the Easter fool does not worship Jesus. What we've seen over these last few weeks is the way in which Jesus demonstrates his authority throughout his time in Jerusalem. His authority over the events, his authority over the people. And yet time and again we hear that the events of this weekend were nothing short of a tragedy. What a shame that someone so promising and so good had his life cut short in this cruel and brutal way. Maybe his betrayal, maybe his mistrial, maybe his execution was the greatest example of innocent suffering. But we've seen how Jesus has been in control. And there are just a few examples here. Glance back to verse 63. Sir, we remember how that impostor said while he was still alive, after 3 days I will rise. Look at what the angel says to the women in verse 6. He's not here, for he has risen as he said. Jesus is in control. He has said he will rise from the dead. And that's what we're now seeing played out before us. He's told the disciples that he will meet them on the mountain in Galilee. It's there in verse 16. Now the 11 went to Galilee, to the mountain to which Jesus had directed them. You see, there's no need to fear. The women and the disciples, there's no need to fear because Jesus is in control. He's done exactly what he said he would do. And because he is the one who has authority and has demonstrated that authority, the women's response and the disciples' response is absolutely appropriate. What is the women's response? Verse 9. Behold, Jesus met them and said, greetings. And they came up and took hold of his feet and worshipped him. They fell at his feet. Jesus doesn't rebuke them for that. This is the right thing to do. This is the appropriate response to him, who he is, and all that he's done. The disciples make exactly the same response. Verse 17, when they saw him, they worshipped him. Well, given that he's done what he said he would do, given that he's conquered death, why wouldn't you believe in him? Why wouldn't you worship him? Just glance again at verse 17, because I think the authenticity of this is strike, isn't it? When they saw him, they worshipped him, but some doubted. The word means hesitant. They weren't quite sort of there with everybody else. Not all the followers, and I guess we're talking about 120 rather than the 12, but it may be some of the 12. Not all Jesus' followers were immediately convinced. And of course, throughout the ages, as this Jesus has been met across our world, in so many different venues and places, and at so many different ages and stages of life, this is still the right response to him, to fall at his feet, to recognize him as Lord and Master. To worship him with the service of our lives, each and every day. But take encouragement if you look at others and think, they're actually a bit further ahead. They've got it sooner than I have. Don't worry about that. Just keep going. Keep looking at Jesus. Keep reading your gospel. Keep asking questions. Keep asking God to open your eyes that you may live for him in the future. Who is Easter for? The one who worships the risen Jesus, or the one who does not? And then thirdly and lastly, the Easter fool says Jesus does not have all authority. You see, the fools think they can silence Jesus. The fools think they can stop Jesus. But he is Lord of all. And here we're told, verse 18, Jesus came and said to them, all authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Go therefore and make disciples of all nations. Here begins what we call the universal mission. And the disciples have the assurance that Jesus is in charge of everything. Jesus has all authority. That means that there's no corner of our globe over which Jesus is not in charge. There's no people group. There's no tribe. There's no language. There's no religion either over which Jesus does not have all authority. In our prayers earlier, we were praying for Syria and Yemen, weren't we? Parts of our world where evil men seem to triumph and appalling atrocities have been and continue to be carried out. We wonder, don't we? Does Jesus have authority in those places? All countries where the good news of Jesus is outlawed, where you're not allowed to speak it publicly, where you could lose your life if you convert it to Christianity. Does Jesus have authority there? What about the apathetic and the disinterested that seem to populate our part of the world at the moment? Maybe family members who've had every opportunity but shown no sign of bowing the knee to Jesus. Maybe friends that we've prayed for years and brought to many things. They've heard the gospel again and again but haven't responded. Is Jesus Lord over them? Does he have authority over them? Well, look again. Jesus says, all authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. He is Lord in all those places and over all of those people. There is nothing that falls outside of his remit. So that should give us great confidence. Confidence as we pray for folk. Confidence as we look at our world. Confidence as we go as Jesus commands us to do. Because that mission given to the 12, given to the disciples, passed on through them to the church throughout the ages. And it falls to us today to make sure we continue that job. We do it with respect. We do it appropriately. Of course we do. But we have all the authority we need to do it. Now, you've probably heard people say, well, of course, I need to earn the right to speak in this situation or to that person. Well, these verses challenge that, don't they? Because Jesus has already given you the right to speak. Because all authority is his. These verses also challenge the idea that we just need to live a good life and we don't need to say anything. There is speaking here. There is teaching here, isn't there? Of course words are important. Jesus gives me the authority to speak to people. Gives me the authority to teach about him. Some years ago, I used to work in Eastbourne. And there's an annual tennis tournament in Eastbourne, and I knew one of the BBC commentators at the time, and he would very often give me a pass to go around the venue. And because he was who he was, it was a pass to get absolutely anywhere, any court, any practice area, anywhere. It was an access all areas pass. So I didn't need to ask to go anywhere. If I met a man on a gate, I just waved my pass because Gerald had given it to me. I didn't need to ask the man on the gate if I could go in. The pass told me I could go in. Access all areas. That's what Jesus gives to us. He has all authority over everybody, everywhere. And he passes on that authority to those of us who are called to make disciples. All nations without distinction. I'm told this morning I didn't mention Africa or Eastern Europe. So I'm very sorry for not mentioning Africa or Eastern Europe this morning. I've done so now. All the world, all people groups are involved. And Matthew's gospel from the word go has been telling us exactly that. The first verse of the gospel tells us that Jesus is the descendant of Abraham. That is, he is the one through whom God will bless all the families of the earth. Chapter 2, who is it that comes and offers gifts to Jesus? It's the Magi from the east. Chapter 4, where does Jesus' mission begin? It begins in Galilee of the Gentiles. And just a few chapters earlier in chapter 24, Jesus has said that what will mark the time after his resurrection and ascension is that the good news about him will be preached to all nations. Go therefore and make disciples of all nations. And these disciples, once the Spirit has come upon them, will become disciple makers. Through them, the church comes into being. Through them, succeeding generations continue their work. And all that is needed is Jesus' teaching to see the church through until the end of the age. And that's the promise at the end of Matthew's Gospel, isn't it? And behold, I am with you always to the end of the age. He is Emmanuel. He is God with us. He's with us until the end of the age. So just as there's no place or people group over which Jesus doesn't have authority, so there is no time over which he doesn't have authority. The worldwide mission is possible because of his perpetual presence with his people. And that's great to remember, isn't it? When things are tough, when we find it difficult to be a Christian in our place of work amongst our friendship group, when we find that people don't want to listen to what we've got to say about Jesus, when we find people don't want to accept invitations to come to events or to sign up for courses, we just need to remember that Jesus is Lord, that he is with us at those moments. And that's the encouragement we need to go on, keep praying, keep speaking. Just go on doing what he has commanded us to do. This role is ours because we've been given it by the risen Jesus, the one who has authority over all time, all people, and all places, the one who has promised to be with us forever. Who is the Easter fool? The one who believes in the teaching of Jesus, or the one who does not? So where does that leave you this Easter? Do you still regard Jesus as an imposter? Do you still think he's perpetrating a fraud on the human race? Or have you come to see him as the risen Lord, the one to whom belongs all authority, the one who must be served, the one who must be proclaimed to all nations? Which are you? Who is the Easter fool?